in the rank of colonel. I was in from 1984 to 1998 active, inactive from 98 to 2001, and then I went back in 2010 and retired in 2021. I was back at Fort Sam Houston for advanced officer training when Iraq invaded Kuwait. Our class was interrupted, and we were told about this unfolding event and told that in all likelihood, at some point, we would probably have to mobilize. Well, that was in the summertime in 1990, and we didn't really have any repercussions on the reserve side until shortly before the holidays, and things were beginning to ramp up, and units were being mobilized. And shortly before Christmas, the reserve unit I was with, the 44th General Hospital, was given their notice. We were given a verbal warning to be prepared. So all through Christmas, every time the phone rang, we jumped wondering if this is the call. Christmas came and went. New Year's came and went. And we were like, to the point of, can we just get this over with? And shortly after New Year's, we got the call saying, this is it. Report to home station. You're being mobilized.
Veterans Voices, The First Gulf War, is produced by AMPRS, diverse radio for Minnesota's communities, and is made possible by the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund.
The viewpoints expressed in this program are the opinions of the people expressing them and are not necessarily those of Fresh Air Incorporated, its staff, or its board of directors.
You're listening to Fresh Air Community Radio, KFAI 90.3. FM Minneapolis, St. Paul, and around the world at kfai.org. Non-commercial, community-powered radio. 1 o'clock at this time is the Northern Sun Radio News Show with your host, Don Olson. And today we have a couple of in-studio guests who will be talking about their Vietnam experiences, veterans, and we're going to... And I have an interview for later on, but we're going to start off with Phil Oakes talking Vietnam.
Sailing over to Vietnam, Southeast Asian Birmingham. Well, training is the word we use, nice word to have in case we lose. Training a million Vietnamese to fight for the wrong government and the American way. Well, they put me in a barracks house just across the way from Laos. They said you're pretty safe when the troops deploy, but don't turn your back in your house, boy. When they ring the gong, watch out for the Viet Cong. Well, the sergeant said it's time to train, so I climbed aboard my helicopter plane. We flew above the battleground, a sniper tried to shoot us down. He must have forgot we're only trainees. Them commies never fight fair. Friends, the very next day we trained some more. We burned some villages down to the floor. Yes, we burned out the jungles far and wide. Made sure those red apes had no place left to hide. Threw all the people in relocation camps. Under lock and key, made damn sure they're free. Well, I walked through the jungle around the bend. Who should I meet but the ghost of President Diem? Said you're fighting to keep Vietnam free for good old democracy. That means rule by one family and 15,000 American troops, give or take a few thousand American troops. He said I was a fine old Christian man ruling this backward Buddhist land. Well, it ain't much, but what the heck? It sure beats hell at a Chiang Kai-shek. I'm the power elite, me and the Seventh Fleet. He said, meet my sister, Madam Nu, the sweetheart of Dien Bien Phu. He said, meet my brothers, meet my aunts, with a government that doesn't take a chance. Families that slay together, stay together. Said if you want to stay, well, you have to pay over $1 million a day. But it's worth it all, now don't you see? If you lose the country, you still have me. Me and Sigmund Rhee, Chiang Kai-shek, Madam Nu. Like I said on Meet the Press, I regret that I have but one country to give for my life. Well, now old DM is gone and dead. All the new leaders are anti-red. Yes, they're pro-American freedom sensations against Red China and the United Nations. Now all the news commentators and the CIA are saying, thank God for coincidence.
Drop my headphone, and here I am back at it, right? Okay. And today, I have two guests in the studio today. Strong Buffalo, who is a Dakota, a poet. He was a Vietnam veteran, drafted into the Marines, joined up the Marines, 1968 to 70, and he has a group that he fronts for, that plays, sings for, called Buffalo Weavers. And I have Dave Logsdon,
hello,
who of course is the president of our local Vets for Peace Chapter 27. Welcome, yeah, both to talking here.
And I'm also a Vietnam veteran, Don, and I was a U.S. Navy in the fall of 1967, which incidentally is where Tet was going on in theater. I was floating up and down the coast of Vietnam, and for the most part it was pretty uneventful until you got north of the DMZ, and then we exchanged mucho firepower with the well-entrenched North Vietnamese short battery.
Even being on a ship, you were getting incoming.
We got hit twice. We had to go back to Subic, have a couple big holes. One of them hit the captain's cabin, which nobody really shed any tears about. He had to sleep with the proletariat a little bit more.
Subic Bay, of course, is in the Philippines, which is a distance away.
Yeah, right. So we had to limp back to Subic Bay. Yeah.
And Strong Buffalo, why don't you talk a little bit about what you wanted to say about your memories of Vietnam, and also you have poetry that you have. So yeah, start right off as you wish.
All right. Thank you. Like you said, I was drafted. So I went in the Marines instead of the Army or the Navy like Dave.
Yeah.
And I had grew up with Catholic welfare in the Twin Cities, and there was an Indian from Cass Lake, was my foster brother's brother. He was about 6'7", 6'8", and he went into the Marine Corps, and he had a eagle feather he had gotten, and we saw him before he went into the service, and I was pretty impressed with that. And I kind of grew up with the stories of, you know, like Ira Hayes, and so I was kind of, I believed in the whole baloney that was given to us, and went to Vietnam expecting to hold up all those dominoes falling and the whole bit. And I thought, you know, because I didn't have a family that I knew of, and I wasn't married, and that if someone could die, I could. And I hadn't registered for the draft. I had run away and from boarding school. And so I figured, well, I could die. And when I went over there, and until the first shot was fired over my head, did I realize I didn't want to die. I wanted to live.
You had an epiphany about living.
And so I really worked at coming back alive.
Good. So yeah, it's when you get right there, when you have hot lead coming your direction.
Yeah. Well, my first operation was Way City in Tet of 68. But like you said, I'm a poet, so I'd like to read a couple poems. This one is on title. From my war, the combat time, soldiers' faces have faded. The names have been forgotten. But the death stays alive in me. The places are kind of unknown. The wounds are scars that heal fresh underneath my flesh. But I lived on for those who did not. And this one I call Agent White, Agent Orange, White, and Blue. Those are the names that they gave the pesticides that they sprayed. And I never knew what they were doing. They'd just come flying by and spray this stuff, like crop dusting. And we'd get full of it. You know, I remember wiping it off my face. But anyway, this is Agent Orange, White, and Blue. While the enemy was digging caves to hide underground from the chemical war of the United States to force out the guerrilla, the smart men of war forgot or intentionally allowed their own sons to stand naked above, breathing the agent brother's stench. I am now the son of dioxin, and you shall see me groping out of hidden underground caves, looking for you, Uncle Sam.
Wow, nice. That's the first time I've heard that poem.
Oh, yeah.
I thought I heard all your poems.
Well I wrote a lot. it's kind of, you know, I woke up in Vietnam. I was kind of badgered by welfare and being an orphan. And when I got over there and went through the Marine Corps stuff, it made me start thinking. And I realized that war was wrong and that what we were doing was wrong. And, you know, in fact, the nickname that the Marines gave me was Ho Chi. They called me Ho Chi, like Ho Chi Minh, you know. And, you know, I kind of, you know, the Vietnamese also treated me very well. I was surprised. I would be a point and come into a village, and they would just surround me. And, you know, just like a rock star. I felt like a rock star walking into town, you know. And they'd be saying in Vietnamese, they'd say, well, we taught them, like, number one, number one, you know. Number one was good, number 10 was bad. So they'd always be coming up to me and say, number one, number one. You know? Samey same, they'd say, you know, samey same eyes, samey same hair. And I said, no, 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 no. And then after a while, I started, oh, yeah, I think maybe we are, you know. And I started to realize that how wrong we were. My last assignment was defending a mobile gas refineries. There was two of them out in the bay, and Highway 1, that went to Vietnam, was for transportation, and Coca-Cola plant. And this was my assignment. I realized at the time this was economic and that it was totally wrong. And so I'm so surprised to find that here we are 50-some years after that, and it seems like that conflict that we was so far away is now here in the United States. The same ingredients are here. I mean, democracy falling down, the dominoes. We're worried about this goofy guy trying to be an authoritarian and ruining democracy and scaring us all and trying to build himself up. And we're living with all these lies. And I think it just makes me realize that the war that we fought then, it's the same. You walk outside the streets and, you know, there's murder and there's these deaths that are going on with drugs and all this homeless and all these problems that we should be devoting ourselves to instead of sitting around being threatened to lose our security in our old age or our health. And so it's the same war is existing as back then as now. And I think we need to really wake up and realize that we have to stand up now and be real more than ever. We have to be proud. I'm proud to be a liberal, progressive, do-gooder or whatever they want to call me. Because I feel that people are the most important thing in the world, that life is sacred, that this earth is worthy of us to take care of, and that each other, we need to take care of each other. And that's what I feel that America was created for, that I used to wonder why everybody came to this land. And I said this at the Capitol the other day at a protest with, you know, thousands of people. I said, you know, this land is for all of us. It's a common destiny, not manifest destiny where Americans or Europeans have the right to interfere everywhere. It brought everybody here to learn how to live in a higher order. And I think that's what we're trying to learn. And I think people are trying to stop that now by creating fear because of money or whatever reasons they have. The main thing is we have to learn how to be a family here and put aside the differences of our skin color or our class or any kind of difference, put them away and end war. We have to start living in a new world that knows that talking is better than bombing. And the madness from the military needs to be stopped. I mean, it's just way out of line that they're cutting all this stuff for people and keeping the wars going on. It's just ridiculous, the genocide that's going on, ethnocide that's going on up in Ukraine and Gaza. So I think, you know, to me, what I was taught to be a American soldier really is helping me now. When I look around, as a point, I used to look for danger. And the danger is sitting in the White House. It's sitting inside your next door neighbor. It's sitting in the police force. It's sitting right there in front of us. But also your comrades are in next door and in the high places. So the polarization that's going on in the world today should make us really realize we have to grab hands and hold on to each other, those that think alike, that feel alike, because that's what's in this polarization. It's like a civil war that's going on internally. And so I'm glad to be on this show with you and Dave, because I think, you know, we have to wake up and face this stuff and start dealing with it.
Well, Buffalo, you're a walking point for peace. You're the walking point for peace.
Oh, thank you.
You know, just so people know, a point person, like when you were with your Marine Corps squad or whatever, the point person goes out ahead by themselves just to see what's going on. It's actually a pretty dangerous position often, because you're there to draw fire, perhaps, and save everybody else. But you have these noble words now which go into it. But it's something that God instilled in you because of your being a point person there.
I think the reason I became point was we were in a major operation, and I saw the enemy, and I pointed him out way before everybody else did. And we'd go by the clock, and I pointed him out at about 8 o'clock, and then 9 o'clock, and then 10 o'clock. At about 11 o'clock, they finally stopped and went out to check what I was talking about. and we got caught in an ambush. So that night, the battalion commander said, who is that guy that was shouting, you know, they're over there? And so they brought me in, and he said, you're going to be my point after this. So me and this other Marine guy, who was another Indian, he was a Pima Indian from Arizona named Cage Blackwell, became scouts. And, you know, I did everything in my power not to run into an ambush again. And I never did get ambushed, and I never had to kill nobody. And I made a point of it. I was good at it because I could deal with this stuff. Some people had never slept outside their own home, had never gone hungry, had never been under distress or been bullied or anything. But I had gone through it all. And so when I went over to Vietnam, it was all easy. I could see farther than other people. I could hear better than them. I could smell the enemy a mile away. And I tell everybody, hey, they're coming. They're over there. Let's go this way. And at first they used to say, oh, you're goofy, you know. But then they started to realize I wasn't goofy, that I knew what I was talking about.
So, Tom, whatever happened to your good friend, the other indigenous guy?
He got shot by a sniper, and then a head injury is a top priority. So we called in the helicopters, medevacs, but that sniper kept him going. As soon as they'd come near, he'd shoot and they'd fly off. And so we were going up and down this hill, this large hill, and we couldn't get him out of there. And it was like overnight. He was in the afternoon, he got shot. And overnight, we had to hold him, and he started regressing. And I remember at first he just said, well, now I'll really get to go home. Just normal, like we're talking now. And then he just started regressing because it was a head injury. He was hit in his head. And so he started talking like a little kid, you know. Oh, I want to go out. I want to see my mom. Where's my mom? Mm-hmm. My mom's mama, you know. And I was like, you know, going bananas, you know. And then finally there was a helicopter coming the next morning, and we saw it, and we called out to it, and he said, we got a medevac, we need him to go back. And the pilot said, I can't. He says, I can't stop. He said, I'm on a mission, he said. You know, we were saying, what's the mission? You know, and more important than one of our guys that needs, you know, attention. He got hit in the head, he got shot in the head. And he said, I got to deliver the colonel's ice, his ice for his beer. And we just went, what? You know, what the hell? You know, and said a few other words. And that pilot just went on. And Cage died there. And, you know, I have written a piece that I call Colonel's Ice about that. That the ice for his beer was more important than one of our people.
Wow. I'd like to hear that poem sometime. You haven't got it with you, do you?
I do, yeah.
Sure.
You could. All right. It's kind of more like a prose, but it's called The Colonel's Ice. I grew up being force-fed the John Wayne lies, that he shot and killed all the real Indians in the fantasy world of Hollywood. I wondered why the Indians always lost all the battles in those movies and books, not realizing who made those movies and books, what they were intended to do, exactly perpetuate that myth, that Indians were gone, that the white guys won it all. I also grew up watching Ira Hayes, the Pima Indian, put up the flag on Iwo Jima for the Marines who died drunk in a ditch. But I was also blessed to be exposed to the native world early in my childhood when my foster brother, older brother Brian, joined the USMC and visited our foster home He was 6'7", Ojibwe from Cass Lake Reservation in northern Minnesota. In his uniform, he showed us his eagle feather that he had been given in a ceremony that would help him to return safe and unharmed. This made a huge impression upon me that years later I joined the Marines too. When I got to Vietnam in 1968, I met a Pima Indian from Arizona. Both of them ended up being used as points a lot of the time because war came easy to us. We became squad leaders and were used still as points. Our troops respected us both a lot. Once a very good sniper for the North Vietnamese Army shot a few points. Kenneth Blackwell, or Cage, that we called him, he took over point and got shot in the head. His unit went into shock. His first, he was just staggering around. His first lieutenant was staggering around just saying, KG got shot. He was so admired by his all he could have went home early. When our base was overrun by Viet Cong with satchel bombs, they would all get stoned and just have breech cloths and come in and blow up stuff with hand grenades and those satchels. They temporarily blinded Cage with a grenade, but he fought off two of them barehanded and they retreated. His platoon asked him to stay and he did. So when he got shot, it hit us all hard. I remember he was joking. He told me, now I can really go to home. A head injury is top priority. So he had requested a medevac copter to come in fast, but it received some fire from that sniper and took off. We went up the hill, same thing. It dragged on for a day. Cage began to regress, babble, and then cried like a baby. I remember being so upset, feeling so helpless, not being able to do anything for him. I saw a helicopter off in the horizon and we called out. It was our battalion commander's helicopter. We asked him to take Cage. He replied to my disbelief, no. He couldn't stop. He had to get back to the rear before our colonel's ice melted for his beer. Cage did not make it. I cried as I heard him sing what sounded like a death chant or was his last breath. Everything from that day is cloudy and fuzzy in my mind. I remember that officer left soon after that, and we were all at the rear camp when he flew off. There's usually a gun salute, but we heard on our radios to stop shooting that rounds were hitting his helicopter. Cage got a Silver Star for his first attack. He was the bravest soldier I served with, and we got drunk in the rear area once and saluted everyone of our loved ones, our family, those we didn't even know. I only had foster family then. He sang some Pima songs, told me all about his reservation and people, and I will always honor him.
Wow.
Yes, you mentioned that you had grown up in a boarding school, which has been more and more coming to light of what a stain it is on the history of the United States and Canada, especially too, and it was, of course, designed to, how did they say, beat the Indian out of you?
Well, I didn't even know. They wouldn't even tell me what race I was. Some social worker had said that I was emotionally immature. Well, of course, I was a kid, and that I wasn't supposed to know. And they weren't going to tell me until I was 21 years old what nationality I was. So, I mean, every day in my childhood, I go crazy, you know, like, what the hell am I, you know? And I kept going, like, and I finally got to high school, and I asked my counselor, I was in Boys Town, Nebraska, and I asked my counselor, I said, what am I? He said, I can't tell you, you know, and he had a big stack of papers on his desk. And finally, I'd go there before baseball, before basketball, before football. And every day I'd go there and I'd ask him. He had about seven kids, an Irish Catholic guy. And finally said, I got to go to the bathroom. I'm going to be gone 5 minutes. If you look at these records, that's up to you. And he took off. So I looked in there and I saw my mom's name, you know, Germaine LeBlanc, and the home was Veblen, South Dakota. Nationality, Sioux, Indian, and father unknown. I went, So I found out what I was, but that was about it. Took me a while to get to meet my real family.
Natives have probably the highest percentage of people go into the military.
Yeah.
And some people say, well, what the heck? They were treated so poorly by manifest destiny, by settlers going out there and might makes right, and we are, you know, God guns, guts and guns.
But we're the sovereign. Indians are the sovereign of this land.
Yeah.
Sovereignty didn't come from king or queen of Spain or England or France. It come from the Indians. And we're still here. After all this genocide and extermination and all this treatment and all that stuff they did with border, we're still here.
Well,
I was 4 years old, and I had never stayed in a place more than 1 month. I was in, you know, like 105 different social placements. I was moved more than your trash. But, you know, I survived it. I found my people. I found my ways, and I realized this land is ours. It's a different way of looking at it. We don't look at it in ownership like we got the title in our pocket. Yeah. We have a relationship with it. This earth is our mother. And you treat your mother with love. And that's what we do. We might be the ones that are suffering from alcoholism and drug addiction and poverty and all this kind of stuff of being outsiders. But we're the real power here. If you look at any Indian today, the reason in their name is a solution. For Dakotas, you know, it means friendly people. The Ojibwe's, it means the original people. The Ho-Chunk, it's like people with a big voice. Every one of them says the people. Yeah. The United States of America does not say the United States of people. Because it isn't.
Yeah.
It's everybody ran away and was persecuted from someplace else and came here. And now they're trying to stop that. I mean, why? Because they're worried that there's not going to be enough for everybody? This is such a myth. Everybody, there's enough here for us all.
Yeah.
We can keep on building houses. We can keep on creating phony money and all this kind of stuff and live. The main thing is the real things, love and compassion and kindness and goodness. Those things are what's important, not how big your stock returns are or your bank budget is or your fancy car or designer clothes. The main thing is how many friends do you got? How many people do you help? How many people are helping you? Because hard times are going to come to us all, and we're going to not have to worry about beating each other up, but sharing. Because it's going to take a little bit to learn how to give a little bit and not stuff yourself to the max.
Yeah, so true. You know, our friend Mitch Walking Elk, he was on stage with Larry Long, and Larry was going to sing Woody Guthrie's "This land is your land, this land is my land, our land," right? And Mitch walked off the stage.
Uh-huh.
He said, "No, it's not." You know, I just think in our good friend Chris Matanupo wrote a whole book about the settler colonizing and how the genocide of the Native people in this country was almost 97%. 97%, that's a conservative estimate of how many indigenous people were killed.
But the fact is, today, everybody that's supposed to be liberal or progressive are the Indians. That's who they're after. That's what's happening. You're all, you know, I have a poem that I started writing. I said, how does it feel now that the privilege is being erased from you? How does it feel now that you're not, you're being ignored?
Yeah.
How does it feel that you're being discriminated against? And people are beginning to start to realize what it feels like to be persecuted like that and treated like that. But we survive. We survive. We will survive all this stuff. We've survived over 35 presidents of, and terms of whatever they are, up and down, left and right, and good and bad, and blah, blah, blah. And, you know, it's just because we've got a loudmouth in there. I'm the same age as that guy in there. And I realize, you know, what a fool. I mean, this is a fool. This is a clown. And he's sitting there representing. He's the commander in chief. That's a guy whose finger is sitting there with I don't trust him. I don't believe in what he's saying. And I know there's many people that believe that he's the great hope or whatever. But, I mean, when you start terminating stuff like color, just because for the sake of what, you know. I mean, yeah. White is a color, too, you know. And you start getting this inclusion and stuff, you know, trying to terminate those that need to be included because you don't think there's enough to include them. Well, what is going on?
Yeah.
Now, common sense has to take over.
Now, Tom, your group that you are part of is the Oyate Houghton, and basically what you're doing, Oyate Houghton, is you do the Buffalo Show, and but you do more than that. Do you want to talk a little bit more about your work?
Yeah, well, we're kind of like a native-led arts group, and we put on different kinds of forums for. To help the minds of people. You know, we say for the next 500 years because we want people to realize that it's going to take beyond our generation. We have to lay the seeds now that will, you know, bear fruit maybe, you know, because I was taught, my understanding of seven generations is that it's three generations back. That's my great-grandparents. They were in Fort Snelling. There was 10 of my family in Fort Snelling and more down in Mankato. And three generations ahead, your great-grandchildren, I have like 10 of them. And then you, in your present generation, you are the middle. And so it's like you can see this. You could talk with them. You could actually be alive with the seven generations from the past and the present. And that's what we have to start to begin to realize, that we're not just selfish, solo, temporary, kind of solitary figures, that we're a lot more. And so it's this kind of thinking that needs to be brought back. And those that are standing for good and compassion, I think, have to stand together, because we got to make ourselves get beyond war. We don't need war. It's just a big business, and they're just making a lot of waste. So we need to stop that and spend it for something better.
Yes, that is our only hope.
Yeah.
Because instead of just always thinking about how can I make a buck off this something or other that you find here or there. I mean, something as basic, Winona LaDuc said, you got to love water, not oil.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I got another poem. Can I read it?
Yeah,
why
please,
did you do
this?
How about the Walking on Franklin Avenue?
That's what I'm talking about.
You've read my mind.
Okay, well, you read my mind.
Easy read.
I'm the poet.
It's like a comic book.
Walking down Franklin Avenue straight out of Vietnam, I saw the Minneapolis police throwing native people into paddy wagons like sacks of drunk potatoes. That image, it's still so clear in my mind. All those bodies laid out on top of each other. This aimless walker questioned, pointed out that they were human beings I was told to mind my own business, that they were the law. And then the anger blew up within me. And AIM was born there on Franklin Avenue, too. We all began to stand up, speak out about that brutality and all the centuries of injustice so big that it can never be undone. We followed our hearts and not our rational minds down that street, over the roads, through all of Indian country. We walked into a historic change. We, the AIM, still evolving, are still revolving. We had to survive all that hate. We patrolled the streets with our noble native blood. We picked ourselves up, some sober and some not. We revived our dormant culture. We began to piece together our fragmented circle. If we heard of someone hurt, we reacted. We responded. We worked. We cared. We recreated the rebirth of the indigenous soul, the native pride of the original ways, following the natural laws, walking down Franklin Avenue, past police, City Hall, and all that hate to aim for freedom. We chase the dream down of our before. We are AIM, the American Indian Movement, forever walking down Franklin Avenue.
Well, you know, it was so inspiring during the 60s when AIM was happening and things were happening on Franklin Avenue, because it was so exciting that throughout much of society, we were all starting to wake up. I mean, like the civil rights movement.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, that's not right what's going on down south, and we found out up north, too. And then the women's movement. Oh, they're not, you don't call them girls.
Yeah.
You think differently about it. That was a gay liberation movement. American Indian Movement here, it was so exciting that all these people were saying, here's my reality, here's how we add to this world. And we've had to learn more about how it all fits together. I mean, I found out a heck of a lot more about the history of the U.S. I mean, I'd studied it. I also always felt bad for how some of the groups, Indian groups, were hounded. But I didn't know how to put it together with everything else, that it was part of this making of a national empire.
Mm.
And that
In like 1924, it's both when Indians got the right to vote and women got the right to vote.
That same year.
Yeah.
Oh.
So it coincides. You know, it's like the founding fathers, the white guys that founded this country, went and studied the Iroquois Confederacy.
Yes.
To find out how democracy and all that worked. And they plagiarized it. But they forgot, I think, an important ingredient, which was clan mothers, the grandmas. The women had the real power. They could take out any war chief, peace chief, any leader. They could make the policy and make the direction. United States needs clan mothers back. They need to reinstitute this to where there's some grandmothers that are sitting in there that nurtured and fostered all these children and grandchildren and great-grandchildren to realize that we need life. We don't need death and consumption and confusion. We need understanding and caring that takes a hug and a kiss and a smile is much better than a shout and a pounding, which is what is happening to us all now. We're all running scared.
Well, and on May 13th at the Bryant Lake Bowl, you can catch Tom and the Buffalo Weavers and a whole bunch of other folks that are going to be on the bill for that show.
Yeah, it should be a good show.
Can't wait.
So if you can.
So that was May 13th.
It's Tuesday.
Tuesday.
At 7 p.m.
7 p.m. Bryant at the Bryant Lake Bowl over on Lake Street and.
Yeah, it's Bryant and Lake Street. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, and I know you've been doing that for.
Since
a
about
while.
2016, I think.
Is that long?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, it's an interesting performance space there. It's very good and all that. It's it's interesting how the what's going on now, where they're really, really trying hard. People who think that they're in charge of everything and everything, that they're trying to declare an emergency.
Yeah.
And you got to hate these people over here because they don't have the right documents. Mm-hmm. And even though they've been 10 years here, making fine, upstanding families, working, got to pick them up by the ears and toss them into the refuse pile. You do start to see some people are starting in some of the letters to the editor and sometimes on some of the...
I do remember a story about immigrants, people, anti-immigrant people that were in some place in Arizona, and this native guy started yelling at him and said, you're the immigrants. Go back to where you came from.
Yeah, I bet that caused him to... What the heck are you talking about?
Yeah, where do you deport the native people?
I don't know. We're home, you know. That's.
And natives had developed a long-term strategy for living.
Yeah.
How to live in harmony.
Keep your mother alive.
It's always a good plan.
And learn how to get along. The children just don't know how to get along. And I think it's going to take some strong people and people with courage to stand up and be good. Because that's what we need now. We need good, kind, compassionate, reasonable people that being real. Because these unreal people are going nuts. And, you know, I don't sit there and take it lightly. I think we have to really reinforce ourselves stronger than ever. I'd say be a little bit gooder each day. If you just have one little good thought that you can have that you didn't have yesterday, the world's off a little bit better. Because there's some nut that's got 35 bad ones, you know, more than he had the day before. So I think we need just to reinforce each other and say, hey, all you good people, let's join together and take back this world because it belongs to us all.
Yeah. We all have to be people who, as you say, support Mother Earth. And you think seven generations, three back, you said, three forward. Sometimes it's seven forward, but it's... You want to make it so that the world can continue because right now it's getting hotter and hotter and the water is getting whatever, the oceans are too hot. So, but it takes people to not hang back thinking, well, maybe Washington will, they'll do a little buh-buh-buh-buh-buh-buh and then it'll be okay again.
Yeah.
But that's not how... Well, that's not how a civic democracy where we all participate and we all make it, we all got to go work together and go into that. And it's that's something we should carry in from what was learned.
Yeah, it's it seems like the modern American thinking right now is more like 7 weeks rather than seven generations. It's like people are looking into their cell phones and they're not worried. I was saying that the national bird should change from the eagle to the ostrich, because that is one of the biggest problems. Although I'll have to say this, about the current resident of the White House is that he's gotten people's attention. The last couple of things over at the Capitol, it's like 35,000 people. There's going to be another big group there today at 4:30.
Yes.
Immigrant rights.
Yes. I think it's called A Day Without Immigrants. 4:30 at the state capitol. I have a sheet over here. I'm going to grab it. But Strong Buffalo, why don't you talk about You're talking to that large group at the state capitol when you were asked to be part of that, how you went about thinking about it and going into it and what you did.
Well, I just told them that, you know, for over 500 years, this has been the land and the refuge for the world's refugee. Why let hate stop that now? So it's the reason that everyone has come here is to learn how to live together in a higher order. And we're a long ways away from that, but that's what we need to do. We need to realize that this is the new world, that we need to make a family, and that we're all relatives. Matakwi Oyase has been interpreted as all my relations, but it really means I am one who's trying to be a good relative in a world of unknown. And that's what we all are, trying to be good in this world that's full of so much strange stuff.
That's why it was so confounding during the last presidential election when you had, during when Biden was still president, you had every day all these bombs exploding in Gaza. And it couldn't be an issue. The candidate, the Democratic candidate and the Republican candidate, all they do is, they can't see that if people don't, you know, complain about genocide, what are we here for? And the psychological impact. Well, in fact, I've been alerted that in June there's going to be a psychologist coming here, who coming from the occupied West Bank, in the Palestinians, the having to do with the trauma that it sets off, because it is. When you're living under it all the time, there's no nothing which is different. That guy, the Palestinian guy, who was a leader in some of the stuff in Colombia, he lives in Vermont. He says he had to come here to know how it felt to be freedom of movement, freedom, try to be freedom of speech. But now, both sides, there's hardly anybody in the official world that can say, open your eyes, look what's going on every day. Don't keep sending huge amount of munitions there.
Well, you know, and I think oftentimes that people are, they just want to say, Republicans. But you know when Biden was in there, and they said, well, Biden, he got Leonard Peltier out of the prison. Well, he did it like 2 seconds before he was walking out the door. He could have done this 4 years ago, but he didn't. He waited, let him wait 4 more years.
But, I mean, if you look at war and what's going on in Ukraine and Gaza, who's making those bombs? Who's the ones that's profiting from that war? It's us. And we're responsible. They're making war in our name. They're killing people by the thousands in our name, destroying these countries in our name. And we have to stop them. I don't want war anymore. I don't want anybody to be killed in anywhere in our name. So stop it.
That would seem to be the rational normal
yeah.
human
yeah.
thing to do, but it's really yeah. hard to get traction. And the fact that there's such a retribution against those who are trying to speak out against it, and if your hero is a green card person or a student visa, it's that you are attacked by the current administration, even some of the others, but it's... Do you have another poem?
Yeah.
Let me just say, I'll jump here quickly with a quick recommendation. Since this show was about Vietnam, essentially, we got off into a strong buffalo just do his thing, and I like that because just listening to him and his song, his poems and his words of wisdom. But there's a Netflix, of all things, there's a series on Vietnam, and it's really good. It's really powerful. It's not like, you know, the Ken Burns documentary was, it started off with, we went to Vietnam with the best of intentions, which automatically kind of made it null and void in my mind, because there's no way we had the best of intentions. And we lost 56,000 American soldiers, and more than that came home damaged and suicidal and using all kinds of things to self-medicate. You think about all that death and those, you look at the wall and you look at all those names, and you think that more than that came home and destroyed themselves and their families.
Well, I got this poem called Us, the Trees and Leaves. Under the dark and pandemic sun, the wildfires are burning us, and the sparks of social justice are ablaze. We find ourselves, but we find that we are all broken spirits from the arid past, just falling leaves, just motionless human trees, lost and confused, fluttering. Even the best of us is full of questionable doubt. Yet it always changes when we see this spring bloom, and each season life renews. After us, same as before us, same as now. We are becoming the trees and leaves, alive and strong, even in our weakened world, where it's less than before. We shake, we fall, we cry, we wither. But relatives, with our family of the air, the water, the land, and life, we must love being ourselves and share with each other and know that we are now the glorious and beautiful trees and leaves who will give the good air to breathe and provide the cool shade from the pending heat, because our roots are deep, our seeds are good, our limbs are strong, our great purpose should be full of compassionate love, for if we fall, we will always return until the end of times. We will always now be the beautiful trees and leaves that are standing up for what is right.
Well, thank you, Strong Buffalo.
Thank you, Don.
Poet, Dakota, as you found out.
Yes.
Vietnam veteran, drafted, went into the Marines 1968 to 70, and he has a Buffalo Dream Weavers. Buffalo Weavers, and Dave Logsdon, president of the local Vets for Peace. This has been the Northern Sun Radio News Show with your host, Don Olson.
Welcome to MN90,
Rockstar,
Minnesota
Randy.
History, you know, in 90 seconds.
Good evening. 5 weeks ago, the Communist Army...
May 8th, 1972, President Nixon went on television to address the nation. The president announced the mining of Haiphong Harbor, in effect, an escalation of the same Vietnam War he had promised to get America out of. Before, the large anti-war protests seemed to happen someplace else. But May 1972 was the University of Minnesota's turn. Thousands of students turned out, and the police did too.
They had the riot gear, and they were...
Bill Hunziker was a young reporter with the University News Service in 1972.
They were fixing for a fight. That's the way...
Batons flew. Tear gas erupted. The National Guard trucked in. Protesters went to the hospital. Minneapolis was suddenly national news.